Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson. Welcome to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio, and a big hello to all of our listeners around the world, New Zealand, Ireland, England, and we've got a fabulous show planned for you tonight. It is springtime at the Wild Animal Compound here in Indiana, and we've enjoyed beautiful 80-degree weather all week, and it's quite inspiring, and I'll tell you, all we're waiting now is for a nice spring, gentle rain, and those morel mushrooms will be up in the woodlands, so very exciting. In fact, here's the key, folks, to finding these mushrooms. First of all, you have to see a butterfly, you have to see a bee, and you have to see a snake. And the redbud trees. Well, we filled all of those categories. Last Saturday, I saw the first snake of the year, black rat snake, and it was in a briar bush as we were trying to remove this briar patch. Bumblebees are everywhere. I've seen a butterfly, so we're ready. So all we need now is a little bit of rain, and we'll have magnificent morel mushrooms. And I'll tell you what, I love catching them. I don't like eating them so much, but I'll tell you, in the country, those morel mushrooms, they're like gold. I mean, you could trade, you name it, you could barter anything for those morel mushrooms. So it's a lot of fun. I always enjoy this time of year. Of course, as always, joining us with the Wild World. Did we lose a connection?
Sounds like it.
But with the Wild World News, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Henry.
Good evening, Mr. Batson. How's everything at the Wildlife Educational Services?
Well, I think okay. We got this bizarre beeping, but looks like our technician Henry May is taking care of it. So what's going on in the Wild World News tonight?
Well, let's see. There's all kinds of things going on in the nature news. Let's see. Let's start out tonight in, let's go to Dover, Delaware. State officials are looking for volunteers to help with an annual horseshoe crab count, which has been conducted since 1990. You ever counted crabs before?
I'm not going to say a thing.
All right, well, I just thought I'd ask. The data will help the scientists to monitor changes in the number of crabs. Volunteers will count crabs on selected beaches in Delaware and New Jersey in May and June. And they're going to have a little training session in case you don't know how to count horseshoe crabs.
Well, what would be involved with that?
Well, I imagine a piece of paper and a pencil.
Well, you know.
Yeah. But anyway, they're pretty interesting creatures if you ever encountered a horseshoe crab before.
Yes, I have. Tell you the truth, I have. So, and they are fascinating. That's a great story,
yeah.
Henry.
I guess they're pretty closely related to spiders.
Absolutely.
House day spiders.
That's right.
Okay, well, let's run off to Portland, Oregon. In addition to restoring a commercial Chinook season in California, the Pacific Fishery Management Council gave tentative approval to Oregon commercial and sport fishing Chinook season along the full coastline for the first time in 2 years. California's commercial salmon season could resume in just a few days, despite worries that it could endanger low salmon runs. Now here they've said it's okay to fish because everything's good, and now they're concerned that there's not going to be enough salmon. Go ahead and fish, but...
Huh. Well, they know best.
I guess. Okay, well, let's run off to Concord, New Hampshire.
Let's go.
All right. Well, a biologist said a winter survey of bats in the state shows that 5 of the 8 species have been affected by the white nose syndrome, which we've heard about the last few years. It's a fatal disease that can spread to bats, that has spread to bats in like 11 states now. The Fish and Game Department said the bat population numbers declined overall by like 66% this last year.
Well, that's serious.
That's serious. And
absolutely.
The white-nose syndrome was first discovered in New York, in a New York cave in like 2006. Now, a lot of people don't know that the bats pollinate. They each bat can eat like 100 insects a night.
Well, a colony of bats can eat, imagine this, 2,000 pounds of mosquitoes in a season.
It's unbelievable.
2,000 pounds. So, yeah, it is unbelievable. So, I absolutely
you know
what this, go ahead.
You know what a mosquito weighs?
Well, not
yeah.
really, but not very
not
much.
Really,
but,
yeah, that's
but,
a lot.
But if you're talking about a decrease of 60%, that has insurmountable effects. So
now,
that's scary.
When I was stationed in the service in El Paso at Fort Bliss, I used to drive into Carlsbad, New Mexico to see the bat flights during the summer. The caverns contain like 600,000 bats, and every night like 250,000 leave the cave.
Mm-hmm.
And the cave is, instead of being a walk-in cave, the cave is actually a hole that goes down into the ground. And in the evening when they come out, they start a little spiral, like a vortex, like a tornado.
Mm-hmm.
And as they come out, they create this this vortex, and then they spin off into little circular groups that go out above the desert. And I guess they fly in the circular pattern, and it causes the insects to kind of, the heat thermocline kind of raises the insects up to them, so they don't have to go down and search as much for them. But it's,
wow.
If you've never seen it before, it's something to see.
I'll bet. Never have,
all
maybe
right.
One day.
All right, we got a little sad news here at the Buffalo Zoo in New York. Fred, an old grizzly bear, just passed away this last week. He's been at the zoo only for about 8 years, but he was moved from the Grizzly and Wolf Discovery Center in Montana. Bears normally only live 20 to 25 years, so Fred had a good life. We'll just have a moment of silence for him, because like you, he was an educator.
Oh, absolutely. And also a good friend of mine who is now the head vet at the Buffalo Zoo, Kurt Voley, who was our vet for many years. In fact, I want to have him on the program, so I have to get a hold of him. But, yeah, well, the bear was in good hands if Dr. Voley was in charge of the deal, so.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, we're off to Grassenville, Maryland. Democrat Governor O'Malley said the Chesapeake Bay blue crab population has increased 60% over the last year. And a dredge survey showed that the crab population is in its highest level since 1997.
That's fantastic.
It is fantastic. It's good all the way around, because, you know, one thing involves another creature and another creature down the line. Anytime we lose something or the population dwindles, it involves a bunch of other species also.
Well, it does, but especially when anything's involved in the fishing industry, when the population goes up, boy, that's incredible. Because we always hear about the, you know, you spoke earlier about the salmon, decrease in salmon, and how they're going to monitor the fishing. So, yeah, that's fantastic news that maybe the oceans and seas aren't as polluted as one thinks. It's causing these problems.
Okay, we're going to take you to one of your favorite places now, Colorado.
Oh, my Lord.
Now, this is pretty interesting. Grand Junction, Colorado. A high school science teacher has discovered what authorities said could be the first skull fragment from a rare dinosaur. The fossil was found in the Dominguez Escalante National Conservation Area in the western part of the state. The Bureau of Land Management said the fragments appear to be first from an armadillo-like dinosaur called the, let me see if I can get this right, the Ankylosaurid.
That's pretty close.
Yeah.
I know exactly
so
what
anyway,
you're talking
about. That's pretty cool for a high school teacher to.
Hey, that absolutely. You know, thank goodness he was sharp enough to realize what he had discovered. Because a lot of folks would have found something like that and never even thought of the possibility of what it could be. So that's fantastic.
Yeah, and the armadillos in those days were the size of Volkswagens.
Oh, they were. And that species that you're talking about, I only know this because when I was a youngster years ago, I was quite the dinosaur enthusiast. So I got a chance. I read everything about dinosaurs. So Roy Chapman was my hero. He's a paleontologist that worked in. I worked around the world, but love those dinosaurs.
Yep. All right, let's go to Kenai, Alaska. The bears are waking up from hibernation. The Department of Fish and Game says a couple reports have been received of bears walking around and they're just waking up for their season. Usually, generally, they come out of hibernation from March to April, but it changes every year just depending on the weather.
And I want to explain something to my listeners, and a little bit later, our guest tonight is Dr. Bryce Finney. He's a veterinarian. We'll talk about that later as well. But bears do not truly hibernate, because if it is a nice day in the middle of winter, they will come out of their den. They just don't like. My bears, and I have two black bears, they just don't like to get their feet wet. They just don't like snow. They don't want to be bothered. But they don't treat now animals like your ground squirrels and your groundhogs. Now these creatures hibernate. And the reason I say that is because when I first started doing lectures 31, 32 years ago, one of the animals that we featured in our lecture was a woodchuck. But forget it in the winter, because I'll tell you what, even though we kept him in a heated garage, he would curl up in a ball, he would cover himself up with newspapers, he didn't eat, he didn't move until spring. And our bears that we have, they eat year-round. Now what wild bears will do, this is called a bear plug, is they'll eat wood to basically cause them to stop up, to be constipated. And so they don't really, you know, have to eat in the winter. So when they come out of their, not really a hibernation, but when they come out of their dens, that's the first thing to do is pass that bear plug, and then they're ready to eat and put on all that weight that they lost over the winter. But that's a fallacy. They don't really hibernate. That's Yogi Bear hibernates, but he's not real.
Hey, boo-boo.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, now here's something close to home. You're going to like this story.
Okay.
15 years after the state, Bloomington, Indiana, 15 years after the state began releasing hundreds of river otters and its waterways statewide, wildlife biologists said that the furry mammal, once considered extinct in the state, they're now thriving.
I bet.
The National Wildlife Refuge near Seymour, the park ranger Donna Stanley estimates that several hundreds of the creatures now call the area home.
That's great. That too is fantastic. You've had a lot of fantastic stories tonight, Henry.
Yeah, and you know what? People say that when I'm wet, I kind of look like an otter.
Yeah, I agree with that.
All right, the last news item that we have tonight comes from Great Falls, Montana. This is for all you cat lovers out there. A 3-year-old cat credited with saving lives by tapping on its owner's nose with a paw to alert her of a gas leak has been awarded the Purple Paw by Great Falls Animal Foundation. Schnotzy received her award at
the What's the cat's
foundation.
Name again?
Schnotzy.
Oh, Lord.
Schnotzy received her award at the foundation's annual Furball. She received her award at the annual Furball.
I heard you the first time.
Trudy Guy and Snelty woke said that the cat woke her up after a gas pipe had broken above the shutoff valve. Firefighters said the house could have exploded had the cat not warned Trudy.
You know, that's quite unusual for a cat.
Quite unusual.
Because usually cats don't seem to give the whether you're around or not. that's quite remarkable. I have to say that. So that's the Wild World news, Henry.
That's the news for the night.
Well, thank you very much. Absolutely outstanding. Almost all the program or the stories were on a positive nature, so that's always good. We have a fantastic guest tonight, everybody. In fact, I've been talking to him for weeks and weeks, trying to negotiate this appearance tonight, and finally we were able to get the job done. He was awarded the Bronze Star as a member of the Green Beret Special Forces. He has been involved in 3 world conflicts, fighting terrorism in Africa, Iraq, Afghanistan. And I know him because, first of all, he was our USDA inspector because he is a veterinarian. And now he's a Dean of Veterinary Technicians for Harrison College right here in Indianapolis, Indiana. And with great pleasure, we'd like to welcome to our program tonight, Dr. Bryce Finney. Hello, Doc.
Hey, generous introduction. I think most of that is true. It's great. You did talk me into it. I mean, I was hesitant at first, but you got me talked into it, so here I am.
Well, we appreciate it. Well, so, agree with me or not on the story on the bears and hibernation?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. They bears have and I have had the opportunity to live in Alaska for a while and did some bear viewing on Admiralty Island, the brown bears. And these guys have this thing called brown fat, and it's a subject of scientific study because it gets metabolized so differently that it does allow these bears to, you know, go long periods of time with very, very slow metabolism
Did we lose him?
Yep.
Oh, Dr. Finney.
Hang on, I'll get him back.
Okay, Henry. Well, Dr. Finney will be back in just a few moments. This is the wonders of Blog Talk Radio. And, you know, these things do happen. But I met Dr. Finney. In fact, he pulled up our driveway. He was the first USDA inspector. Let me explain to everyone, because we have exotic animals here at our animal compound. One of the people that we have to answer to is the United States Department of Agriculture and the Animal Welfare Act. And every 6 months, 4 months, you never know when they will come out and overlook your facilities and
Larry, I'm back.
Oh, fantastic. And I was explaining to everybody a little bit about how we first met, but we want to get back to Alaska. And you were the first USDA inspector that ever came up in a Jeep. And he actually looked the part.
Yeah. They said, "Be careful, Larry Batson up there." But I got up there and Larry, you weren't all that scary. I don't know if that's a persona that you were supposed to have, but.
Well, I try not to be. I mean, I have to tell you the truth, Doc. When I spoke to you, I knew within 10 minutes that we were on the same wavelength. We had a lot in common.
Yeah, and absolutely.
So, anyway, we were talking about the Alaskan bears.
Mm-hmm.
And you were explaining about how they were able to slow down their metabolism.
Yeah, well, it's this brown fat phenomenon. It's something that we don't have, but that bears have, and you can read all kinds of accounts from Lewis and Clark to just other bear hunters, where these brown bears can be shot, you know, pretty much right through the heart and lungs, and still keep going for quite some time and run down the guy, the person, the hunter that shot him, and sometimes kill him. And I attribute that to the metabolism of this brown fat and the way that they can go into a stupor and have just this different type of metabolism. And I don't know if you guys caught it before I lost the signal, but you know, this a subject of scientific investigation and study because of the implications for space travel and things like that. So.
Wow. So when you were up in
interesting stuff.
Oh, it is. So when you're up in Alaska bear country, is that always in the back of your mind?
Well, it does need to. I mean, you need to give the bears their space. You need to know that you are in their backyard and that you are a visitor there. They'll try to avoid you, but if you spook them or do something, you know, try to approach them and things like that, you know, a bear, brown bears will, they can do a number on you.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, always accounts of when they get somebody, they actually just take their head in their mouth and just kind of like pop their head. So, anyways, something you want to try to avoid. But yeah, you're in their backyard, so you got to think about that. But they, you know, they're not really to be feared if you're aware and you let them know that. That you're there and you don't try to approach them, you won't have any problems. I mean, we did a fly-in on Admiralty Island, and I had my daughter, who was probably 4 years old at the time, and my son. They only let a few people a day on the island, and there's about 1,200 bears there, so it's about one bear for every square mile on the island.
Wow.
And then they come and pick you up. But anyways, you're sitting there, and you know there's bears walking all around you. They're fishing and getting salmon out of the rivers and things like that. And I didn't hesitate to bring my young daughter and my family out there amongst the bears, just as long as you're careful and you know what you're doing and you give them their space, they're fine.
They're really, people don't, you know, they don't understand bears that they're probably one of the most secretive animals. And they're totally focused when food's involved. That's their total focus.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're amazing. And what is also so remarkable about them is their intelligence.
They are very intelligent animals.
Yes. I was once told by a gentleman, I can't remember who, that he thought they were maybe as smart as some of the great apes, except they just don't have the facial expressions.
I could agree with that. I mean, they're very intelligent animals. They don't use tools, but they definitely use their claws and things like that. You know, as close as using a tool as you can get. They are real remarkable. I think they have really great memories bears are always been one of my favorite creatures to study and to be around.
So as a youngster, Doc, what got you interested in becoming a veterinarian?
I did not actually, being a veterinarian is a second career for me. I started out being a soldier, and I did a little bit of both, but veterinary medicine, I've always had, in most people, I mean, as the dean of the School of Veterinary Technology for Harrison College, every applicant I read their, they write an essay to get accepted, and I read those, I read all of them. And there's one thing in common. I mean, animal people, we kind of have one thing in common. We have this affinity for animals. We kind of can relate to them as fellow creatures, as maybe brothers and sisters on this earth, rather than, you know, an adversary or something to be feared. And so I think that's one of those underlying things that you have. And you're either in my opinion, you're either born with it or you're not. And there are plenty of people that are. Well, mm-hmm. I happen to be one of those people. So I've always had that affinity for animals and felt like I could relate to animals on many levels. And then as a special forces person, I got involved with some medical training, and then I met my wife, and I thought, you know what, I need to do something a little bit more domesticated than being a Green Beret on Special Forces team. And so I thought, well, you know, I like animals, and I'm good at this medical stuff, so veterinary medicine made a lot of sense. So I did that, but it was kind of like out of the pot and into the fire, because I'm not sure that being a veterinarian, especially when I find myself up at Larry Batson's, you know, castrating a 498-pound black bear, that it's any more domesticated than being a Green Beret.
That was quite a day.
Yeah, it was. I think I used, I don't know how many of your listeners can appreciate this, but I used, like, I don't know, 4,000 milligrams of Telazol to get to knock that bear down, and that is a boatload.
They've got a strong constitution.
Yeah, they do.
Well, here is the problem with, well, it wasn't really a problem, but the two bears that we had, we also had a female that was in the same enclosure. Now, I offered that once we had the male out, that I'd just keep her away from the procedure. I'd just shoo her away. Well,
right. Now, although I appreciated the offer, Larry, I was looking for something a little bit more comfortable than shooing her away. So we decided to use a little Lizol with her, too.
Yes. And I can still remember the two future vet techs that were over there keeping track of her vitals, and she let out a grunt or a snort.
I thought they're about ready to jump out of that enclosure. Yeah. There'll be something they'll never forget.
Oh, absolutely. And we had discussed it that day that those young people have no idea that what they witnessed and how many times. I mean, I thought you said that was the first time you've ever taken care of a male bear like that before.
Yeah, yeah, it was. Absolutely was.
So it was a great learning experience for everyone. So
it was.
And you know my wife, Cheryl, she said, Dr. Finney, man, he's a rock star vet.
Yes, yeah, well, she assisted. I mean, she was a great assistant. She, you know, she obviously is very comfortable around animals too.
Oh yes, yes. She's done a remarkable job raising this bobcat, and it's now close to a year old, and she can still handle it.
Hmm.
So that in itself is quite remarkable, and still goes to schools with us. So that's something else. So Doc. I mean, to be a veterinarian, that requires a lot of schooling. I mean, so you left the service for a while to go to veterinarian?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I did. Actually, I was, like I said, I was in the service, and I was on the Special Forces A team, and I left. I went into the reserves. So I came off active duty. I was in 10th Special Forces Group when I left, and that operates out of Colorado now. At the time, it was Massachusetts and in Europe, but in that kind of an Arctic team, so we did a lot of skiing, a lot of mountain climbing, you know, those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, I stayed in the reserves and then was accepted to Purdue University and went to school there. I finished up my undergraduate in 89, and then I went on to veterinary school after that at Purdue. So yeah, I took some time out of the military. I was married at the time. Again, that was one of the reasons I did the change. And my son was 2 months old at the time, wasn't even accepted to Purdue. And I said, my wife just said, we're moving out of Massachusetts and I'm going to Purdue to go to vet school. She says, well, you haven't even been accepted yet. I said, well, I'm not really worried about that. Let's just go and I'll get in. Well, when you're young, you're dumb. You don't get that. You know, you're just like, okay, let's go do this. And fortunately for me, I was able. I mean, it all worked out for me. But it, you know, that's kind of the way I live my life. Well, I think I'll just go do that, you know. Find out later that, you know, it's not that easy to get into.
It's not. And it's, yeah, it's incredible. It's remarkable. I mean, I have more respect for you, Doc. That's just, we're going to take a break. We want to remind everybody that tonight's program is underwritten by We Want You Cottages in Chautauqua Lake in fabulous western New York. And they have a very exciting thing going on their website. It's called iKids Fishing. It's a kids fishing website where they can upload pictures of a fish that they've caught, and they can compare them with children, fishermen all over the world. And it's a We Want You Cottages, and that website is www.weanchu.com. We Want You Cottages. So be sure you check that out. Also, once a month, they're going to award a weekend fishing trip, and that includes a cottage and a 16-foot boat at We Want You Cottages in western New York, and that's a random drawing, and that happens on the iKids Fishing website, and it's involved with the picture. So be sure you check that out, and big thank you to the Weimers up at We Want You. I know they're listening tonight, and we really appreciate their help in supporting our program. This is Larry Batson. This is Larry Batson's Wild World. We're going to take a short break, and you're listening to Blog Talk Radio.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Here's a hot topic about our wildlands and living with the natural role of fire.
Yard work is not just a matter of pride when you live in the wildland-urban interface. It's also about survival. Here are some FireWise tips that can help protect your home from wildland fire. Prune your trees 6 to 10 feet above the ground. Remove dead leaves and branches and dispose of them before fire season. Water your lawn regularly and store firewood away from the house. Be prepared for a fire emergency by having a plan for your family and pets. Learn more at our website and then sit back and enjoy. You worked for it.
This hot topic was made possible by the Teresa and H. John Hines III Foundation. Learn more about the natural role of fire, how to protect your community, and get the latest fire information. Visit the National Interagency Fire Center website at NIFC.gov. That's NIFC.gov.
Hi, this is Pat Green. The blood supply is at critically low levels, and you can help. Call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE. That's 1-800-GIVE-LIFE. Schedule your appointment to donate blood. Your donation is critical because every 2 seconds someone in America needs blood. That's accident victims, surgical candidates, and cancer patients, just to name a few. Please donate blood and encourage your friends, family, and neighbors to give too. Please call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to make your appointment. Thank you.
Hi, this is Paul McCartney on behalf of RAD. If you're drinking, you can't drive my car or any car. Remember, if you're partying this holiday season, don't drink and drive. Got it? It's just not worth it. Doesn't make sense. Thank you.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Duty, freedom, country, family. They're the values that make America strong and what our armed forces are fighting to defend.
While many talk about these ideals, without action, they are just empty words.
If you think America's military families deserve more, log on to thanksusa.org. It's a great way to thank our troops and give military families the gift of education.
Thanksusa.org. Scholarships for America's military families. You can make a difference.
We're Rascal Flats. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, do you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters?
Bobcat, heavy. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean? Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second, I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everyone. This is Larry Batson. Welcome to Larry Batson's Wild World. We've got a fantastic guest tonight. He's awarded the Bronze Star as a member of the Green Beret Special Forces. He's involved in 3 world conflicts. We're going to talk a little bit about that tonight, what he can discuss about it. And now he's the Dean of Vet Techs in Harrison College right here in Indianapolis, Indiana, Dr. Bryce Finney. Doc, it's been a real pleasure tonight.
Yeah, it's been a good conversation so far.
Yeah, we'll try and ruin that now if we can.
All
let's
right.
Let's talk a little bit about what you've been involved in. As we spoke a couple mm-hmm. nights ago,
yeah,
a very important topic, the war on terrorism, and a lot of the things that go on that people have no idea what our country is behind.
That's true. Some of the things that we get involved with and that the country are doing, people just don't have any idea. And the interesting thing is the things that we do are real feel good kind of things. I mean, we're doing the right things for the right reasons, and there's a lot of people working very hard to do that, and had the opportunity to do that in Africa. Obviously, after 9/11, 2001, the world changed for most of us, and certainly the soldiers had their opportunity to go out and do those things. And I was fat, dumb, and happy in Indianapolis. I was a practice owner, had 2 companies and 3 veterinary practices, and was still in the reserves as a commander of a special operations unit. Now, that's a little different than special forces, but mm-hmm. it's still a part under the umbrella of special operations. Mm-hmm. And anyways, I was company commander for a civil affairs special operations unit, and 9/11 happened. Well, I saw the writing on the wall, and I was happy to do it, but I and many, many other patriots out there, I sold my practice and I was deployed for a couple of years, doing some of the heavy lifting in the early parts of the war. My unit was deployed to the Horn of Africa, which was six sovereign nations, to include Djibouti, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Sudan, Kenya, failed state of Somalia, Yemen, and that's where we operated. And what we did there, there are some things that I can't talk about, but there's many things that I can, and these are the important things, I think. We went there to provide civil affairs. So we did veterinary civic action programs, we did medical civic action programs, and engineering civic action programs. So we drilled some wells for some folks, we rebuilt some schools, we did, I had some docs with me, some medical docs for people, and we ran some medical civic action programs. I think we saw over 25,000 patients, and we did some veterinary civic action programs. I was the commander, although I brought some veterinarians with me to work out in the field. And we saw about 115,000 animals while we were there. Interesting, the culture in that part of the world, they're pastoralists. So that means that they have their animals, and their goats and sheep and camels and cattle. And it kind of moves up from there. So the camels are like the elite. Those are for the rich folks, the rich pastoralists, and the regular folks like us. And we're sheep and goats people. And in any case, so we work with them. And it's interesting in that part of the world that many of the people, their animals are more important to them than their family members. And because that's how they make their living. I mean, they can get along, they can make more children, but their cattle and their livestock are actually more important to them. We went there to what we call win the hearts and minds of the people. And in my opinion, it's not just my opinion. I mean, this is the way it is, winning the war on terrorism is not necessarily a shooting war. It's one in which we need to win the hearts and minds of the people out there. Many people see Westerners as you know, that they learn in the madrasas that which are run by radical Islam schools, where they teach these young people that Westerners are infidels, and that infidels are for the most part the devil incarnate. And so, they've been doing this for years there. And so we go into these villages as white folks, and these poor kids and just the people there are looking at us like, oh my gosh, but the world has come to an end. And so we have to dispel that myth. And so we do that by going and just living and working with the folks out there. That's a dangerous job. That's why you have to have special forces do it, or special operations civil affairs folks do it. But that's how we're going to eventually win the war, is when they can look at Doc Finney and say, you know what? He's not such a bad guy. I mean, he can dig a hole. He can walk around and kick the manure just like everybody else, and everything's fine. So. So that's what we did there, and it was a very important work. And probably at the time that we left, which was in 2004, our mission was considered probably one of the most successful missions in the global war on terrorism up to that point. And these are things that you just don't hear a lot about. When it talks about the roadside bombs and those kind of things, but there's an awful lot of this civil affairs, what we call civil affairs work going on in both the Horn of Africa and Iraq.
Is it still going on today in Africa? Are we still involved?
Yeah, it is. And yes, I'm still involved, although I'm retired. there have been some opportunities for me to go back and kind of continue that work. But there are other people, other units that are going and working out at Djibouti, Africa, which is where we were working out of, and they continue to do that work because, that's part of it is when you build these relationships is to continue them. I mean, if we were just to show up, vaccinate a few cattle paint a school or something like that and be done with it, it would have very little effect, or it wouldn't have quite the effect that we want. So yes, those things are continuing at the moment.
That had to be highly rewarding for the people involved.
Well, it is. I mean, you go there and you really feel like you've made it. I mean, we all, at some point in time, you kind of do some inspection of yourself and say, you know what, did I really do anything with my life? I mean, did I actually help somebody? And after you've been involved with a mission like this, you can truly say, hey, I made a difference. Now, interesting, because you go to a third world country like this, and the first thing you think is, oh my gosh, somebody's got to do something. Somebody's got to change these people. They need to be like us. They need to, have a mortgage and, watch TV all the time and that's the life. And so you think somebody's got to save them. And then you realize that, you know what? You can't save the world. You can't even really change the world. And then you get to a point where you're like, you know what? I don't even think they really want to be like us. And, when you see somebody living in a grass hut, having a good time with their family, they spend most of their time with their family, do a little gathering for their food. They might be a little bit hungry, but they look very, very happy. And then you look at your life and you see, bills piling up and all the things and stressors that we deal with, and you think, wait a minute, who has it right here, us or them?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and so you realize that you're not going to change them, and that they don't even want to be changed. They don't want to be westernized, and that's okay. That's just fine. That's just one of the differences.
You can't save
the world, but what you get down to is you say, you know what, I can't do that, but what I can do is if someone's thirsty, I can give them something to drink right now and make their life better right now. If they need something to eat, maybe I can help them get something to eat. If they need to learn how to, if they need help lifting a heavy burden and carrying it for a while, you can do that. And you do. Everybody does that enough, and then all of a sudden the world kind of does change. So, anyways, those are lessons I learned in Africa.
Well, they're basically, the people live there are part of the ecosystem.
Well, they are. I mean, we went there, and like I said, water in the Horn of Africa, which is the Ogaden, which is the Somali National Regional State, is basically a barren desert. I mean, it has been, desertification has been taking place in that part of the world for a long time. And the Sahara Desert continues to creep south towards sub-Sahara Africa, towards the equator. And you have one real major source of water that runs through there, and that's the Nile. And so the big issues over there are what's going to happen with the waters of the Nile. Well, keeping fresh water is the biggest problem that they have. And you can drill a well and get down and you'll have some fresh water, but in about 6 months, most of those wells are what they say, they go sour. They start getting salty. And you have to go do another one. So there's very little vegetation, and it's overpopulated as it is, overgrazed, and that only exacerbates and speeds up the desertification that's going to happen. And there's nothing we can do to stop that. A lot of people say, well, how are you going to help those people? Suggestions are just send them some suitcases and move them the heck out of there, because, it's kind of an uninhabitable place. But unfortunately, they don't they don't have that option or that choice. But it's the waters. And you know, the interesting thing that you find out too is that these guys, they're not really interested in politics anywhere. They're not really all that interested in Islam or Christianity or American politics or Russian politics or Chinese politics. They don't really worry about that. They're just worried about getting something to drink and getting something to eat today, you know. And so we go there thinking that there's all this nefarious stuff going on, but that's why they're so easily exploited. So we also try to build capacity, show them how to take care of themselves so that they're not so easily exploited, and then that kind of empowers them to take charge of their own destiny and decide what's right. But most of them want to do what's right. There's no question about that.
You were also involved with work in Afghanistan. Can you tell us a little bit about what was involved there, or what you can tell us?
Well, there's a lot of things that, like I said, that are not appropriate for me to talk about at this time. One of the things that that happens when you work with the local people is that it is a way of collecting what you would call passive intelligence, and once you make friends with you know, the local folks, sometimes you know, information can be exchanged. So there is a lot of that going on. Winning the hearts and minds in some of the folks in Afghanistan, to my understanding, has at to this point been very problematic, in that people have been trying to win the hearts and minds of the Afghans for the last, probably 5,000 years.
Wow.
Have not been able to do it. The Russians were not very successful doing it. Is that something that we should continue to do? I'm not sure. I mean, my own personal opinion about that is that in Afghanistan, we go, we get bin Laden, and we just let Afghanistan be Afghanistan.
That's a pretty sinister part of the world, isn't it?
Well, it's a different culture. We would think it's sinister. It's just like in Africa. What we call corruption and, here by Western standards, if you judge their cultures by Western standards, you're going to be sorely disappointed. So what we call illegal and corrupt, they call good business and good government in Africa or other places. So you just have to, you know, look at it differently. To them, sinister may be the word that we would use, but Africa is what it is. Afghanistan is what it is, and I don't think that we should, be in the business of trying to, change those cultures into something that they're not. I think we're going to always be frustrated with that if we try to do that.
What was your impressions of the terrain, the landscape of Afghanistan?
Well, Afghanistan is very mountainous. It is kind of overgrazed. It can look like a pristine wilderness. But it's an ancient land, and I'm not sure that there is any pristine wilderness left. There's probably one of the fathers of our conservation movement, was George Perkins Marsh, and he was an ambassador right around the Civil War time for the United States in Turkey and some areas like that, and he wrote a big book called Man in Nature, and he talked about how these ancient lands just got utilized and utilized and utilized until they're pretty much you know, barren kind of wastelands, and some of them never come back. And so I think that's kind of one of those underlying problems in those areas. You know, we talk about those cultures, you know, kind of living more closer to nature. And that was my expectation, especially with some of the African villages, you know, in the Maasai and some Boro tribes that we worked with. And it was very surprising just how much they weren't connected to their land. And, you know, that surprised me quite a bit. They didn't have a firm grasp of what types of animals were around. I mean, there were main types. I mean, the Maasai and the lion, look, they get it. They've always had this strained relationship because of the cattle and stuff like that. But it was, they were a little bit, I don't know if they've been westernized over the years or what, but they didn't have quite the connection that I had hoped for. Now, there are those that do, don't get me wrong, but just in general, it wasn't as closely connected as I thought. We, you know, if you can walk into one of the villages and start a fire without matches, you're in on the inner circle. They'll accept you, you know. But if you can't do that, they're not going to give you a whole lot of time. But so they are more connected than probably, you know, most Americans.
What but about magic?
They
had
problems that we helped them solve, like, you know, hyenas would come into the villages and, you know, and raid the villages. And they were like, how do we stop that? You know, of course, you know, some of the Marines that we were working out, their solution is go kill all the hyenas. And I'm like, well, that's not going to work. I mean, you know, there's hyenas in Africa. You have to find a way to, you know, to kind of make this more of a synergistic kind of a thing. So we set up, you know, little dump sites and landfills in certain areas that they gave at certain times the hyenas access to. And so they had control over it. So therefore, the hyenas weren't going in and rummaging through the village. They're going to be there. Let's let the hyenas be there, but let's, you know, let's make it so that they don't have to become a nuisance in the past. But the best story I had there was reading the newspaper in Nairobi, and there was a village outside Nairobi, and it had a brewery. Now, if you ever go to Nairobi, you always order a Tusker Buriti or a Tusker Moto, and that a Tusker is a beer, and Buriti is a cold one, and Moto is a warm one. And if you're a native, you drink the Tusker Moto. Anyway, that's my tip for the day. If you go to, anyways, I was reading. So they had a Tusker brewery near here. And these chimpanzees, this group of chimpanzees would come in out of the forest. They would break into this brewery. They would get no, I'm not kidding. They would get drunk.
It.
They would get drunk, and then they would go beat people up in the village. And this was a problem. They couldn't, you know, they couldn't stop them. They go, you know, like gangs and just molest people and everything. So. You know, that doesn't happen here in Indianapolis.
No, it doesn't happen at all. Well, Doc, it's been a pleasure. I hate to cut you. Hey, we got to have you back on, man, because we just barely scratched the surface.
Yeah, I mean, there's some good stuff. So, yeah,
absolutely.
I'll come back on something.
Hey, we want to remind everyone, I assume the Harrison College has a website. Well, how was that? What am I saying? So be sure everyone check that out and... you know, the vet tech, that's a high-demand occupation now. And with the state of the economy, we're looking for, everybody's looking for a future. So that for one who loves animals and loves working with animals, that's a fantastic opportunity. We also want to thank We Want You Cottages in Western New York for underwriting us. And don't forget to go to their website, wewantyou.com, iKids Fishing. And it's fantastic. We want to thank... Henry May for producing us with all the technical aspects. topics of the program, and of course Dr. Henry Day with his expertise as Wild World News. This is Larry Batts, and we'll be back next Thursday, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to have a guest, author, columnist, local television personality right here from Indianapolis, Dick Wolfsey, will be on, and this should be a fascinating hour. This is Larry Batts, and have a great week, everybody. You've been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.